From KCRW, this is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis with a show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Thanks for being with us. You know that thing that happens where you turn a corner in LA and suddenly you're in the middle of a photo shoot?
Okay, so kind of have like a little swaggy, like attitude-y walk.
The Walt Disney Concert Hall downtown, the magic of brand marketing is happening. With lights, cameras, models.
Get a shot of him just flying over.
Then one of the models decides to perch high up on a wall and won't come down until he gets something to eat.
Because I think it's unfair to make him fly three or four times without getting a little bit of food. And so
Adam Baz is like the agent for Jasper and three other birds. He's a falconer whose client goes from posing for the camera to scaring away pigeons and crows all around town. You just gotta feed him. It's a busy life, but it's L.A. Everyone's hustling, even the birds. Reporter Brandon R. Reynolds spent a couple of days with Baz to see what life is like for an urban falconer and his hungry charges.
Oh, he's such a model.
It is a little daunting when he's flying straight at you.
The trick for Riley, the human model, is to hold her gloved hand in a way that looks stylish, but that'll also offer a perch for Jasper to land on. These concepts aren't necessarily compatible.
But then hold it more out to the side, not like an elegant over the head, because he's just not used to that.
What drives us to chase these weird careers? Well, you know, money, exposure, adoration, and if you're a bird of prey, treats.
This is just the deep freezer of death here, so, you know, it's a grab bag of squirrels and rats and mice, rabbit, quail.
Baz starts a day of falconry by cutting up small frozen animals into bite-sized bits. These mouse heads and whatnot are the currency he uses to pay his birds, who are not quite employees and not quite pets, but something else entirely.
This is whole quail and mice just cut up into small pieces.
This small animal chop shop is inside Baz's tasteful house in Lincoln Heights, at the top of a treacherously steep, overgrown road that looks like where a killer might live, which several do.
So everybody's going to be pretty talkative here because they know it's feeding time and flying time.
Great. He lives up here with his girlfriend, two goats, and a very sweet but understandably nervous dog. And then there are the four birds, none of which are falcons, by the way. There's a young barn owl named Archie, two Harris's hawks, Jasper and Fox, and, well, then there's Kanoni. She's a large East African hawk called an auger buzzard. She's mostly dark gray on her head and back, and white all down the front. Very large, very regal, very intimidating. Kanoni imprinted on Baz when she was young, which means they have a special kind of bond.
I got her at a really young age, so she sees me as kind of somewhere, floating somewhere in between her parent and her mate.
And does that cause awkwardness with your girlfriend?
A little bit. She's not a huge fan of my girlfriend.
So you might infer that there's something emotional or even spiritual going on between Baz and these awe-inspiring birds. But as we drive to one of Jasper's gigs, Baz says no.
And, you know, they trust me, and they're comfortable with me, and they're happy with me. Don't get me wrong, but they don't love me. You know, they're not flying to me because it just feels really good inside when they land next to me. You know, they're flying to me because they're hungry and I have food and they can rely on me for that. You know, humans have a unique tendency to project our own kind of feelings and emotions onto our animals. I mean, I even wonder at times if my dog loves me, you know? I don't know. What is love? How do you define love biologically? I'm not 100% sure she does, but
I saw the way she looked at you.
I think she does love me, but the birds certainly don't.
Instead, he maintains his relationship with Jasper and the other birds using a digital scale. He weighs the birds before every flight. If they're too full, they just won't work for him. He's figured out how to control wildness, down to the gram. But what motivates Adam Baz is harder to figure out.
I mean, there aren't many falconers in L.A. It's not a very hospitable place to do falconry.
To legally own falcons or hawks in California, you need a whole series of state and federal licenses. And also, there's a test where you have to know the crazy medieval names for all the falconry gear. But that said, there are 550 registered falconers in California alone. Most people, though, they just use the birds for hunting. The company Baz runs is called Hawk on Hand. Along with modeling jobs, Baz has a regular educational meet the birds type experience in Ernest Debs Park.
Thank you for coming. I appreciate it. Have any of you guys done a falconry lesson or anything like this before? No,
right after the photo shoot wraps, we hustle to the park to meet four bird enthusiasts from Orange County. Baz gives a little lecture and answers questions.
I have three birds for you to meet. One of them is currently... Falconry is a 5,000-year-old form of hunting.
And I regret to report, he tells them the terrible truth about owls.
Owls are not very smart. They're very kind of like instinctual, primitive, almost reptilian animals. But super sweet, very cute. Okay, Archie.
It does this.
So this is Archie.
Wow. Oh my god, can I take a video?
Yeah.
As he takes them out of their carriers one after another, it's like those unboxing videos on YouTube. Except sometimes the boxes bounce around as the birds, and here I'm talking about mainly Archie the owl, get excited about flying and about eating, of course. This is all a unique and fun experience for us tourists to the world of raptors. But for Baz, it's also a way of sharpening the bird's training for the real moneymaker of his business, bird abatement. The next day, right at sunset, we're in Palmdale. The city has hired him to control their raven problem. Hundreds of them are roosting in a park next to City Hall. That means poop and noise. But introduce a hawk or two, and ravens and crows will leave because they don't want to be around birds of prey. And the hawks, they don't usually kill the other birds, but they do get the message.
She's a veteran of the crow and raven chasing world. So what we'll do is we'll just get him. I'm going to put him on the van here.
Okay.
As soon as Jasper appears with his little bell, the ravens all go nuts.
And so now every raven in this park is acutely aware of the fact that he's here, even though he's not actively pursuing them.
Jasper is kind of creating a hostile work environment for the ravens, who just want a relaxing place to spend the winter.
At a certain point, and we don't really know how or why this happens, but, you know, one of them will give a cue and they'll just retreat. And then it'll be just quiet for the rest of the night, usually.
After a few minutes, like magic, the park is cleared. But since the ravens will come back eventually, Baz, or one of the falconers who works with him, has to visit these sites every now and again and fly his birds around.
One of the cool things about ravens and crows is that they actually pass information between generations. And so these birds will remember this process for a long time. And eventually, we hope that every month and every year, we'll see less and less of them.
The relationship between predator and prey is as much a part of LA's nature as the ancient ritual of fashion shoots and high-maintenance beauties with weird diets. That's what drives all the hustling in this city. Maybe it's not love, but it's definitely hunger. For KCRW, this is Brandon R. Reynolds, just trying to roost somewhere for the night.
Meet a music producer who, like Jasper the Falcon you just heard about, is flying high with a slew of Grammy nominations. That's coming up on the other side of this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. From predaceous birds dominating the food chain to songbirds dominating the charts. That's Kill Bill, the number one hit by SZA. It's up for 3 Grammy Awards this year. You probably know SZA. But a name you might not be so familiar with is Rob Beisel. He's the guy who engineered and mixed and co-produced and co-wrote that song. In fact, he collaborated with SZA on much of her huge hit album, SOS. And the result is 8 Grammy nominations, including the big 3, Song, Record, and Album of the Year. He has another nomination for a song that he worked on with Babyface. Wow.
Hello.
How do you get in with it? Like what happened to you? How'd you get into this business?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a sort of long, gradual process that I've been, you know, chipping away at for a while.
Yeah.
I'm 31 now, almost 32, and my first, like, studio internship was when I was 17.
Wow.
And but I've been, you know, recording Friends since I was like 13 or 14. So yeah, it's just been a long gradual build up over time.
Right, but this is like an LA story, right?
You could say that. Yeah, I guess it's sort of the classic you know, come to the city of, you know, we're the music capital of the world here.
So you came to LA.
Yeah, yeah.
From the Bay.
Yeah.
And you were like, your eyes were focused, right? You were like, this is what I want to do.
Yeah, I mean, this has been the mission since, you know, I first started recording my, you know, Friends when I was like 13. It's been, you know, I've had my eyes on the prize for a while here, and it's been really special over the last, you know, couple years having things really kind of solidified for me. Yeah, it's been an amazing run.
9 Grammy nominations. I mean,
something like that.
No, that's not something like that. That's,
you know, yeah.
It's in your head, that number 9, right?
You know, yeah.
And you want to win all 8 of them. Did you have a sense when you were working on the SZA album that it might turn out to be such a big hit?
I really thought people would enjoy listening to it. I think it's so impossible to, like, predict, you know, chart positions or award nominations, but I really loved listening to it as we made it, and I thought that was a good North Star throughout the process, you know, that if it's something I wanted to listen to, that maybe other people might as well.
It's got a great beat.
It's got a cool...
I promised myself I wouldn't say that on the radio, but I just said it on the radio. It's got a great beat.
Thank you, it really does.
You started working on SOS with SZA right as the pandemic turned everything upside down, right?
Very, very coincidentally. It was not, like, designed around the pandemic initially,
no,
obviously.
Nothing was designed around the pandemic. It all came sort of suddenly, didn't it?
Yeah, I connected with her, like, a month-ish right before, like, January of 2020, and we just happened to really hit it off, and you know, when lockdown started, we just kind of locked in and made some music
at her place in Malibu
for a good chunk of it. Yeah, basically,
really?
Like the first like year and a half.
I mean,
yeah.
what was that experience like?
It was incredible. It was, you know,
I can think of worse places to spend the pandemic, right?
definitely. It felt very like isolated from like all the chaos of the world, which I guess, you know, that's kind of something. Regardless of whether it's like a, you know, global epidemic or just, you know, the usual, you know, global chaos, it's, you know, you don't want that to really, as much as you can, to seep into the creative process. So I felt like we did a good job of that.
What's she like to work with? I mean, just between you and me, what's she like to work with?
She's incredible. I think in music circles, the word genius gets thrown a lot very loosely about people, but I genuinely would apply that label to her. She's just, you know, from another planet.
You, and as we mentioned at the outset, you've been working as an engineer, been doing this since you were a kid, teenager, but on this one you get producer credit as well as songwriting credit too.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how did that switch happen? Did it feel like a natural progression for you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that was like the dream since when I was, you know, 13. I remember like I had heard of Rick Rubin when I was like, you know, 12 or 13. And I remember seeing him in like a, you know, Rolling Stone magazine, like riding his bike in Venice in one of the pictures. And I thought like, man, I want to be like that guy someday. So that's, you know, I've been building towards this type of thing for a while. And it's pretty surreal that it's finally kind of clicking in that direction.
I mean, while you were in college, you interned with an engineer, famous engineer, right? Mark Needham.
Yeah, he's... done all sorts of incredible stuff. I mean, and he's had a pretty, like, incredibly long career, too. Like,
I mean, Killers, Fleetwood Mac.
Right, and even before that, he did, like, the Chris Isaac song, Wicked Game.
Yeah.
So he's been in, you know, a household name within the industry for a while. So I really soaked up a lot from him and owe a lot of my success to him.
You mentioned Rick Rubin on the bike, right, in
yeah,
Venice,
yeah.
Right? You started working with Ruben as a runner at
yeah.
his studio, Shangri-La.
Yeah, I started as, like, an intern there, and then I did the whole classic, like, studio ladder thing, you know, started as an intern, then runner, then assistant engineer, and then engineer. So I was there from, like, 2014, like, right out of college until, you know, 2020, like, right when I stepped away to work with SZA. So.
What's it like at Shangri-La?
It's incredible. It's just...
Is it as eccentric as it's... rep says
it's
indicates
it's not far from that.
Really?
It's kind of like stepping into Wonka land in some ways. It's a special place.
What about his production style? What would you say about Rick Rubin's production style?
I owe a lot of you know, where I'm at to that. I'm such a fan of his, and the way he put songs together and like the way they end up sounding in the end. It's just all about like putting the best and most important stuff to the forefront and kind of getting rid of all the extra noise. I feel like so much of how I approach music making can be linked back to his approach too.
What's next for you, Rob? Seriously, what's next, Rob?
I'm trying, sort of the mission of this year is just branching out, finding new artists that are budding and helping develop them. So that's kind of been where my head's at, you know, finding like the next generations and helping them make their own like breakthrough album. Not that SOS was SZA's breakthrough album, but I do think it helped her, you know, get to another, maybe several rungs up the ladder from where she was at before. Yeah, I just, you know, want to recognize talent and help them accomplish, talented artists, and help them accomplish what they set out to do.
8 Grammy nominee. I mean, are you like pinching yourself right now?
I kind of feel like, you know, in like Looney Tunes when, like, you know, the Roadrunner runs off a cliff and it's only when you look down that you start falling. So I'm trying to not like over process, over analyze this and just kind of like keep on running in the air until, it, you know, the reality sets in here for now. But just, you know, not trying to make too much of it and just kind of go about my normal life here.
It's not just SZA, right? It's Babyface.
Yeah, it's been a good little run of things lately. My friend Chris, who's one of the producers on the song Snooze, he brought me in to do some sessions with Babyface, and lo and behold, that became a song on his album. And he's incredible. He is also, you know, incredibly kind, incredibly hardworking. And that seems like no coincidence to me. And he's, you know, lo and behold, he's one of the greatest to ever do it.
9 Grammy nominations. 9. You really are pinching yourself, aren't you? You have an entourage, by the way, right? Where, I mean, when you were like 17 and doing this, like, you know, you're like, oh, I'm just playing around or whatever. Did you think that's going to be me?
I had no clue. I wanted to, you know, accomplish a lot, but I definitely exceeded my expectations, and I'm hoping to keep climbing from here.
Rob Beisel, music producer, engineer, up for 9 Grammys this year. Good luck to you, Rob.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
I get the sense that it's a lost cause. I get the sense that you might really love her. This sex gonna be evidence. This sex is evidence. I try to ration with you. No murder's a crime of passion, but damn, you was out of reach. You was at the farmer's market with your perfect peach. Now I'm in the basement, planning on my patience. Now you laying face down, got me singing over a beat. I'm so mature, I'm so mature, I'm so mature. I got me a therapist to tell me this other man. I know more than I just want you. If I can't have you, no one will.
It's Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. A few weeks ago, without much fanfare, the city of Huntington Beach, among others, transferred control of more than 6 acres of land to local indigenous populations. The first ever land return to tribal communities in the region, and an historic moment for Orange County. The transfer of the Bolsa Chica Mesa actually happened back in July, coming out of negotiations between Huntington Beach officials and the previous landowners. Our Orange County Oracle LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano is with us right now to talk about this landmark moment. Hi, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
And it is landmark for sure. Tell us a little bit about the Bolsa Chica Mesa. Where is it?
So it's going to be right on the coast in Huntington Beach, so right above the Bolsa Chica wetlands, which beautiful, what I think the official scientific term is like an estuary. In other words, this is where the river, the San Gabriel River and the also the Santa Ana rivers, it spreads out right into the sea. So you have marshes, you have wetlands, obviously wetlands, birds, sea life, vegetation, and all of that. And here's this mesa just right above it. This is where both the Hachiman people and the Tongva people, for decades known as the Juaneños and the Gabrileños, respectively, by the American society, this was a site of a village for them. This was a sacred site for them for thousands of years. And obviously, after conquest, they have had very hard time even trying to get onto the land, but now it's theirs. Under a conservancy, that land is now theirs, the Bolsa Chica Mesa, about 6 acres.
So what about the political significance of this and the significance to the Orange County tribal communities?
Oh my God, this is humongous. So the Ahachaman and Tongva, they are not federally recognized tribes, and they've been trying to get official recognition from the American government for decades. And the Tongva people, they're more traditionally associated with Los Angeles County, and the Juanenos more with South Orange County. But I mean, if you can't even get tribal recognition from the federal government, imagine trying to get any sort of land in Orange County, period. Now, the Ahachaman, they've been able to lease land from San Juan Capistrano for over the past couple of years. That itself was huge. But this land is now theirs. It is under this land trust or this conservancy. That is beyond historic. And this is, especially with the Bolsa Chica wetlands, for decades they've been trying to develop that. And part of this designation does come because of this agreement between the California Coastal Commission, the City of Huntington Beach, and the previous owner of the site. They traded those 6 acres in order for them to trade to be able to develop 2 acres. But still, a humongous victory. I cannot overstate it, and I know I overstate a lot of things.
What stopped the original landowners from developing there in the first place?
The mighty California Coastal Commission. And now I say this sarcastically because we know how hard it is to develop land on the coast in California, not just Orange County, but all of California. Of course, in Orange County, it has always been very, very contentious because Orange County, it's build, build, build. And I remember, geez, this was maybe a decade ago, maybe a little bit more, but as they were doing development, they were going to develop this land, and as they're digging stuff up, they're finding remains, they're finding artifacts, and whenever that happens in California, you have to make a stop to the development immediately, and you have to get archaeologists in to see what was this and all that. And of course, with the Ahachaman and Tongva, they had been saying forever, our people, this was a sacred site for our people. You're not believing us now. You have to believe us. Now, the Coastal Commission in recent years has been very adamant about trying to right wrongs of the past, especially when it deals with so-called minority communities. So we know Bruce's Beach and Manhattan Beach, that's where beachfront property was basically taken away from a Black family. And now you have this case here in Orange County. Again, it's incredible.
So is there any idea what they're going to do with this land, the 6.2 acres? I mean, we know that the other 2 acres that you mentioned, they want to be able to develop it, right? The owners of that land. But what about the other acreage that now in the hands of the tribal community?
Yeah, so the Ahachaman Tongva Land Conservancy, their first task is to secure the place itself, because there is fence around it, but people apparently break in, do BMX biking on what's their sacred land. So they're going to make it secure so that no one could come in. Next up, they're going to take out all the non-native vegetation that's there. We're talking about hundreds of years of non-native vegetation brought in by colonizers, for lack of a better term. They're going to take that over. And then after that, we'll see what happens. I mean, this is a place where you had two tribal communities. They coexisted with each other there.
Do you see any more of these kinds of, I mean, you mentioned the lease down in South County, but what about other leases, other tribal communities wanting to get some of the land back?
You've seen this across California as a state over the past, really in the past 5 years. In Orange County, it's going to be harder because, again, Orange County just wants to develop. I remember in the early 2000s, there was a proposal for, I think it was the Tongva people to be able to run a casino in Garden Grove through this really complex operation. But city officials immediately said, no, this is not going to happen. You folks aren't even federally recognized as a tribe. And in California, of course, you have to be Native American tribe to be able to run casinos. And so what you're going to see now is the Ahachaman and Tongva, this is going to inspire them. They now have a piece of their land back.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, of course, our OC Oracle right here on GLA. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow on the program, hear from the self-proclaimed grocery goblin who's trying to make it to every food and supermarket in Los Angeles. But why? Why? And what does a grocery goblin even wear? Later in the week, homeschool enrollment, as you recall, skyrocketed during the pandemic. Well, now that we're in better shape pandemic-wise, why have so many LA families stuck with it? You can find us online anytime at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Maybe you have a story idea. Maybe you want to get the podcast. You can get the show certainly on the go. It's all there, kcrw.com/GLA, and get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Hope you'll join us online.
Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Kelsey Gante, Eddie Sun, Sonia Geist, John Meek, Phil Richard, Sue Margulies, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Michael Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the show together this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your time. Thanks for that ear. Bye-bye.